I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
Did you ever make anything happen? Anything you couldn't explain? You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what? Dear Mr. Potter, we are pleased to inform you that you have been accepted at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
In a few moments, you will pass through these doors and join your classmates.
Keep an eye on the staircases. They like to change.
Good afternoon, class. Welcome to your first flying lesson. Stick your right hand over the broom and say up.
Up.
Oh, up. Wow. Mr. Longbottom, Mr. Longbottom, exactly where do you think you're going?
Do you really have the scar? Wicked.
Mr. Potter, our new celebrity.
First years should note that the Dark Forest is strictly forbidden. That no magic is to be used between the classes and the corridors.
Petrificus Totalus.
The third floor corridor is out of bounds to everyone who does not wish to suffer a most painful death.
Throw in the dungeon!
Understand this, Harry, because it's very important. Not all wizards are good.
I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed. Or worse, expelled.
She needs to sort out her priorities.
I think it is clear that we can expect great things from you.
Hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? We would like to welcome you. My name is Tim. I am here with our co-host, David, an old friend of mine. We have been talking for ancient ages and eons and eras, no, a few decades anyway, about horror movies and science fiction films. And we enjoy it so much, we decided we might want to do it for the masses. So we decided a few years back to start a podcast that eventually evolved into a YouTube channel where we tackle a century's worth of horror and science fiction films. We try to hit each decade within a season, one or two, maybe three times, so that we have 40 episodes a year. We are unscripted, hence my rambling. Mm. And if you're back with us today because you've been listening to us, then you know what we do and you like us, and we're happy that you're here. So with that said, hello, David, my co-host.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. We usually try to start with an icebreaker of what have you done this week other than research the topic sort of thing. And mine has no relation to science fiction or horror at all, but it is continuing my quest to read more literature or listen to more literature, that sort of thing, and get back into reading a lot more like I've been obsessed with for about a year now. And on my Audible, because I guess my phone listens to me all the time or whatever, it came up with a suggestion for me, which was an Audible original. And I thought, oh, wow, okay, an Audible original, meaning what is it? But it was actually a play. And it was the play version or the audio book version of a play of Glass Menagerie. And Tennessee Williams is not one of my favorite playwrights, but I recognize his legitimacy in the world of theater. And Glass Menagerie is not one of my favorite plays that he's written out of his repertoire. But this was starring Calista Flockhart. And so I went, oh, okay, interesting. Her as Laura, her voice would probably work for that. That would be
I think that may have been something she started a long time ago. Wasn't she known for that as a young actress?
I know she came from theater to begin with.
Okay.
But this was an LA Theater Works production. It was the Roundabout Theater, which is a theater that she's done several things for. But it won a Drama Desk Award. It was essentially her, according to this, it was her Broadway debut. So she, why is that? Now I got to fix this. Hold on. Okay. So anyway, this was her Broadway debut, was as Laura, not this version, because they obviously did this in studio with some other stuff. But the guy that played...
Yes, she played it back in 1994.
Yeah. The guy that played Tom, I was going to look him up for you because he was really great. And I can't remember his name. Hang on. I'm just no good at all at this today.
I think it might have been Kiefer Sutherland back in the 90s.
But yeah, but not for this for this particular audiobook version. I'll have to edit that pause out. He's a Polish actor who's really good, and you would recognize him. As a matter of fact, I think he's done Walking Dead. A very unique name, Zelko Ivanik.
Yeah. He's in the one with Negan and Maggie, Dead City one. He's in that one. He's in both seasons of that.
Great voice actor and really strong in it. And being able to play Tom and play the drunken brother who he's trying to hide his past or what he's been doing from mom and all that. It was just a really good production of it. John Goodman was the narrator of it, which was nice. So, and it was really strong. It was really good. It actually made me appreciate it. I was going, okay, yeah, not my favorite story, but hey, I love the way they did it.
The guy that you mentioned from Walking Dead is not, he would not look like that character at all.
Not at
all. That's why it's a voice thing, yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
So I think it was like where Calista said, hey, or somebody approached her and said, let's do an Audible version of this, and they cast around her kind of thing is the impression I got. So she's playing Laura, of course. Julie Harris.
Yeah, 30-something years later.
Yeah, but Julie Harris played Amanda. And she's obviously way too old for this recording.
She's not. Is she with us still? This might be an old thing. How old is that?
This was recorded in 96. It's when it was
recorded. Oh, it was recorded back then. Okay, yeah. Gotcha. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that makes total sense now. Okay.
But it's a great version. And to be what even Tennessee Williams has called a memory play, to have it just in audio form was cool. The way they incorporated digital effects and atmospheric sounds and stuff like that. So it worked. Memory play sort of thing. But that's what I did. I went to Pseudo Theater World and listened to Glass Menagerie. What did you do? Anything fun?
I did. Actually, it's in common with yours. Yours is a female-centric topic and mine is too. I told you that I recently got Apple and I watched Lisey's Story.
Oh, yeah.
A Stephen King miniseries. This came out in 2021, so it's been around for about 5 years. I just didn't have Apple, so I never saw it.
Yeah.
It was produced by J.J. Abrams. It's 8 episodes. I vaguely remembered the book It didn't make that much of an impression on me, obviously, because I vaguely remembered it. But I did this miniseries more than most. It's directed by a guy, and I don't understand this at all. He must have some pull with Abrams, is what I'm thinking. Named Pablo Larraín, if I'm pronouncing it right.
Yeah.
He's Chilean. I've got that he founded the most popular film production company in Latin America. But other than that, I cannot find another American film that he's directed.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. So. But he did this miniseries for, I guess, J.J. had a connection with him. I don't know. It was written and adapted by Stephen King. And surprisingly, there are some major changes, including the addition of a second sister. There's three sisters total. Okay. In the book, there's only two. The cast is amazing. It's got Julianne Moore, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Joan Allen playing the sisters. Clive Owen he's the male character. And then there's an incredible bad guy played by Dane DeHane. He was in Oppenheimer. You would recognize him. He played Kenneth Nichols in Oppenheimer. And then you mentioned a Luc Besson movie to me the other day, and he's in it too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that Valerian. Valerian, yes. He is incredible in this. You want to kill him so bad. You just hate him in this.
I love hating you in this.
Yeah, he's a young actor. Synopsis is Lisa Landon, a widow grieving her famous novelist husband, Scott. That's who Clive Owen plays. You see him in like flashbacks. 2 years after his death, as she cleans out his study and confronts repressed memories of their intense marriage, his struggles with mental illness and his secret ability to travel to a fantastical, dangerous other world called Booyah Moon.
Okay.
When an obsessed fan threatens her for unpublished manuscripts, Lisa must journey to Booyah Moon herself to save her sister and understand Scott's dark past, ultimately discovering a hidden gift he left for her in that otherworldly realm.
Hmm.
Excuse me. It's so funny. We were talking about Stephen King the other day, and he revisits things so often in his works. And this movie, now that I've seen this, it reminds me a lot of a recent book I read of his called Fairy Tale, where there's another world that people go to, but it's different and it's dangerous and cool at the same time. It's also about a writer. We talked about how he always writes about writers.
Yeah.
It's about his fear of obsessed fans, and literally the character of Scott that Clive Owen plays he's assassinated, or he's shot by a crazy fan, and that's how he dies. But then an even crazier fan is the one that's stalking his wife for the manuscripts, the unpublished manuscripts. Okay. So you've got a lot of obsessed fandom as like an underlying motif. The movie only gets 50, the miniseries only gets 53% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it is not that bad. But it is not your typical Stephen King story, because it's more fantastical, like Clive Barker, if that makes sense, like a Weave World kind of thing.
As opposed to Outsider or whatever, what we watched.
I'm really curious to go back to the book now. I think you should check it out. There's a monster.
I've never
read it. You don't have to. Just watch the miniseries.
Oh, okay.
But there's a monster in it that is really reminiscent of the story in The Hills, the Cities. It's like a giant monster made up of
people.
Human bodies.
Yeah. Cool.
It's pretty cool. It's like a little reach back to the books of blood. I enjoyed it, though. I did not think it was... I thought it was better than 53%.
Okay.
Look at this cast. The cast alone.
Actually works as a segue, though, because you watched a series about a fantastical world kind of thing. Is it parallel to ours? Like the topic we're going to talk about today? Or is it just you go into it and you're in a totally different realm, sort of thing.
You're in a different realm. There's things that are familiar, like woods and sky and water, but it's nothing like what your surroundings are in the real world. No.
Okay. All right. For those of you who don't know, we are going to go back to, 2001? I think, with a little film called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone in the United States. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. Some of you across the pond may recognize it as Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Hugely popular franchise, amazingly popular novelization series, film series, theme park events, everything. More series and being remade. Probably by the time this airs, we will be seeing it. The remake series of it, which is supposedly guaranteed for at least 5 seasons and go through the first 5 books. We'll see from there. If you haven't watched it, read it, heard about it, go do all that now and come back because we do spoil things. But basically, we are on a fantastical story of, before I do the synopsis, a codicil to Tim, rein me in, because this is one of my favorite franchises of all time. And so you will have to say, shut up, David, let's go on, because I will probably ramble all about it, not only from personal experience, but also about the craft itself. But a brief synopsis, we are going to, in this film in particular, we are going to follow the adventure of Harry Potter, an orphaned boy who actually is staying with his aunt and uncle and fairly being abused by them. He actually sleeps in a small bedroom underneath the staircase, which in England they call a cupboard. He's 11 years old, and he suddenly he's had some unique things that have happened to him in his youth, but he can't really explain them, but he doesn't really know. Very sensitive boy, very sweet boy, gets a letter saying that he is invited to attend the Hogwarts School of Magic, of Witchcraft and Wizardry, finds out that his parents, who died, and that's why he is orphaned, were wizards, and the wizarding world coexist with our own world. Harry goes to this school, which is a 7-year school for wizards, to become wizards and
sorcerers.
Live in our world. And he meets best friends that will stay with him for life. He meets enemies that will stay with him for life. An odd assortment of teachers, of groundskeepers, of all sorts of mystical beasts and things. And it's just an enchanting tale. But it leads to the first appearance we have of a villain that stays through the entire franchise of He Who Must Not Be Named, who they call Lord Voldemort, who was also a student who attended Harry Hogwarts School. I think when we first put this on the list, I'd ask, had you seen this movie before? And I don't think at that time you had, but...
Oh, no, I had seen it.
You had? Okay.
It's the only one I've seen. I've not read any of the books or seen any of the other movies.
Okay.
So it's the only thing I've... But so this was my second viewing.
So you're going from a second viewing, no book support thought. What did you think? What do you think of Harry Potter?
I think it's a good movie. It's definitely, especially on my second viewing, it feels a lot like a kid movie to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've got keys that I'll get to later, but so it's fine.
It's interesting. From a personal experience, I'll just
I don't
say,
dislike it.
My daughter said that I had to read this book. She had heard about it at school, that it was really great, and she wanted to read it. So we read it together. I read it to her mostly. She was 11 years old when this book was popular and came out. So my daughter and I read every one of the books and watched every one of the movies together. And so I have a very personal familial thing with this franchise. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting because this is a kid's story. This is not even a YA novel. This is a children's book when you read it. It is written like a children's book. It is intended for children. J.K. Rowling, the author, has said it's for children. And that's one of the reasons why it has two different titles. the studio, the publisher, I think it was Scholastic, no, the publishers, yeah, Scholastic Publishing, said that when it is published in the United States, we have to change the title because kids in the United States won't know what the Philosopher's Stone is. So we want to make it Sorcerer's Stone. That's why it has a title change. But became a huge phenomenon, both literarily and film.
Cinematic.
Cinematically. Yes. Thank you for that word. But it's very interesting. If you do read the novels and if you follow the film series, which probably we will hear maybe one a year or something like that, each story gets gradually more mature, better told, better written, better shot, and darker. A lot darker by the end of it. To go from Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone to Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, which is the last novel. You can tell it gets darker. So, yeah.
Good. But I will like it more.
I'm curious, as we talk through it and examine it, what you like and what you don't like about the film. And I'll try to stay film-centric as opposed to book. For our discussions, it was the film came out in 2001, directed by Chris Columbus, had a screenplay by Steve Kloves, based on J.K. Rowling's book, of course, and also heavily influenced. She definitely collaborated on every one of these movies. Do we want to talk about scenes maybe? And so I can get what you liked and what you didn't, other than.
There's not much I didn't like that I can think of, other than the fact that it's a kids' movie. And the big elephant in the room, which is the creator itself.
Right.
As far as scenes, wow. I think the chess scene is enormous. That's a big scene.
Very good.
It's exquisite. She might have lifted it. Because I seem to remember a scene in Clive Barker's first book, The Damnation Game, that was very similar.
Okay.
I should put that down as a key now that I think about
it. You should.
But I think that's a strong scene. Even though what's his name doesn't die in it, it's implied that he's going to.
Ron Weasley.
Yeah. Ron, yeah.
And mine, again, would be the very opening. I love the way they establish McGonagall and Dumbledore and Hagrid in that first little prelude, pre-credit scene, when they appear on Privet Drive and he's got his D-lighter or whatever they call it, and he's sucking up all the street lamps, and McGonagall changes into a cat, and Hagrid has his motorcycle, of course. And it's basically them depositing Harry at his aunt and uncle's house on Privet Drive. I thought that was a great scene, and it sets up everything. I love the whole sorting hat ceremony, the whole entrance into the Grand Hall and into the Great Hall and the sorting ceremony, and you learn about the different houses and everything else. I think that's a great scene.
The scene where he discovers his parents in the mirror is good.
Oh. In the mirror of Erised, they've got the... And it basically, it's a mirror that shows you your heart's desire. So when Ron sees it, he sees himself as like prefect and head of winning the Quidditch Cup and doing all this kind of stuff. And Harry's, I don't see that. All I see are my mom and dad, which is great.
Other scenes?
Anything else? To me, it's all of them. Mostly, I love the scenes because of what I will rail about the entire time, which is the production design. This movie looks exactly like I pictured it when I was reading the books. So to your point, like Lizzie's story, and you don't have to read the book, just watch the series. It's the book sort of thing. They cut a lot of the book to make these movies. Of all the books, there are things that are cut, hence why I think they're doing this series or reboot or whatever with everyone. But it is so wonderfully crafted visually story. And if you watch a lot of the making ofs or the special editions or all of the behind the scenes stuff and everything else, part of that is the production designer and David Heyman, who is the big producer, and Chris Columbus saying, I've got these brand new actors, all of these kids who are basically, most of them are green. This was only Daniel Radcliffe's second movie ever. And So all of them are green, so I can't have them responding to a bunch of CGI and stuff. So I want as much practical as I can. I want a 6.5-foot guy to play Hagrid. And I want all of these practical effects, even down to the drool and the dogs and the three-headed dog and everything else. So they were making puppets and making huge sets, which are still standing. I'll tell you that story in a minute. But so I think that's what I love most. The two things I love most about all of these movies, but especially this one setting it up, is the production design and the music. I think John Williams' music is great all the way through.
It's a very memorable theme.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And his leitmotifs work. Dumbledore has his own theme. Hogwarts has his own theme. Harry, of course, has his own theme. And it works the way he sets it all up all the way through. But everything, costume design, production design, all the way through it is just amazing to me.
I've got a little bit on production. I didn't realize that Chris Columbus had written Gremlins and Goonies. I didn't, but as soon as I read it, I was like, oh, that's what this movie reminds me of a little bit.
And directed Goonies, too, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there were other people that were considered for it because it was a hot property.
Oh, yeah.
Steven Spielberg, obviously, being the biggest one. But Jonathan Demme, Terry Gilliam, Mike Newell, Alan Parker, Wolfgang Peterson, Rob Reiner, Ivan Reitman, Tim Robbins, Brad Silverman, M. Night Shyamalan, and Peter Weir. Gilliam was J.K. Rowling's first choice, but the studio picked Columbus because he was experienced with children.
Also, so my two things on director are Spielberg was approached first. He was the very first one they approached and was interested, but he didn't want to share creative control with J.K. Rowling, and the studio was supporting that, Warner Brothers. And one of his things was he wanted Halle Joel Osment. Sixth Sense. He wanted him to play Harry, and one of Rowling's big stipulations when she signed her contract was all of the actors must be English or Irish. She wanted that was her big stipulation. And so he backed out, went through all these other, like you said, interviews and everybody. Chris Columbus wrote a 159-page script for it, for his interview, and brought it in and gave his whole vision of what he wanted and how he wanted to do it. And the only reason he was even interested in it is because about 6 months earlier, when the book was so popular, his daughter said, you have to do this. If they ever make a movie of this, you have to direct this movie, Daddy. So that's why.
Those that I mentioned were considered. Mm-hmm. Now, there are directors that wanted to do it, including mm-hmm. Simon West, Robert Zemeckis, Jan DeMont, and Joel Schumacher. Mm-hmm. I can't see Joel Schumacher doing this.
No, not at all. Oh, God, no.
But another one that I think would have been a great choice was Ron Howard, who was approached but declined because he had just finished Grinch and he didn't want to do another kids movie.
Yep.
Baz Luhrmann was also approached, but he declined in order to do Moulin Rouge, which I think was probably a good decision on his part.
Very good. And on their part, too. I don't think Baz would have... Again, there's such a charm and such a kid-centric appeal that our approach that Chris Columbus takes.
But there's one big question looming that you haven't hit. If the cast must be British, then why not the director?
I think it was because J.K. Rowling didn't pick him, like you said, first, and she's one of the ones that helped sway it towards him.
But her choice was Terry Gilliam, which I find hilarious because I wonder if she thought he was British, even though he's not. Because he was in Monty Python.
I thought of that, but she might have said, he's from Python, so he must be British.
He must be British, and he's not.
I think it was Columbus's passion and his pitch and the sell. I think he saw it. I think, and it was a great decision. He directed the first two movies in this franchise and sets everything up perfectly, and then is willing to give it away to Curzon and the rest of them.
That's what George Lucas did, basically.
Yeah, Lucas realized after the first movie he shouldn't direct anymore, but then he did, but that's okay. But the other two show that he made the right decision on Empire and Return. But Columbus, just you watch these behind the scenes and the way he acts with the with Daniel and with Hermione, Emma, and all of that, and the way he directs them and gets what he wants. And then Heyman and all the other, Stuart Craig, who's the production designer, the costume designer, all talking about what Chris wanted and his vision and yada. And we hear that a lot on behind the scenes with directors, but he truly had it. He knew what he wanted for this. And it's brilliant because you compare this to like Back to the Future or Mission Impossible, even Star Wars, like you said. Stuart Craig, who was the production designer, was the production designer for every one of these movies all the way through. So stylistically, everything stayed the same. So that's what
worked. Which is important. Yeah.
Very important. To make a fantasy world feel real, if you have the same visionary doing it, yeah.
Or cohesive. You know,
yeah, say what you want about J.K. Rowling's issues that she's been having post Harry Potter, her vision and setting up this world and what she did, whether she borrowed, was inspired by blah, 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 other things, which we'll talk to in Keys, it mm-hmm. works. It's great. It's a great literary collection. So, again, we talked about
I've also
had that
got
several times where we talked about love the art, not the artist sort of thing. So,
yeah. Yeah, but there's some of that I can't get past. We had talked about, we finished Lord of the Rings, and so we started talking about possibly another big fantasy franchise and this being it. So I did take note that this money cost more than Fellowship of the Ring to make. And it made more money in 2001 than Lord of the Rings did, which is an awesome feat in itself.
Oh, yeah.
But then again, you also had the power of youth. All the children of the world had to see this movie multiple times.
Oh, yeah. That was huge. And just the way they timed it. I think the book came out in 98, I think.
I was working at Borders. It was the first year I worked at Borders. It came out, yes. She did a signing for us.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Yeah. That's cool. So you've had her do a signing, and I actually went to the sets. So when
I want to say it may have been Goblet of Fire. I don't know when that one came out, but I think it was the big one, the fat one.
It's the fourth novel. Fourth novel.
Yeah, I want to say that's the one she did the signing for us with. Yeah, the line was out the door.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's an enormous store. It wound through the store and out the door. But
this was filmed in Leavesden. I think it's called Leavesden, Hertfordshire, England. And they realized fairly quickly, I think after probably the fourth or fifth film, that they had another thing here. So they kept the erected sets and created an entire themed environment around it. It's called now, I think it's called the Harry Potter Studios. But so you can literally go there and visit and see the Great Hall, see all of the special effects, see the Knight's bus from later on from films, all this stuff. And I did. I was lucky enough on a project to be in England. I stayed two extra days to go to this place and went there. And you're supposed to do, it's like a 3-hour tour that you can take through. And I was there for about 8.5. I stayed all day. I took more pictures than I think I've ever taken of anything in my life. Just because it was fascinating. It was amazing the amount of detail that they put into these movies. But yeah.
I can talk cast if
you're
ready.
Yeah.
I've got down that J.K. Rowling handpicked a lot of these people, including Robbie Coltrane, Maggie Smith, and Alan Rickman.
Those three particularly, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Daniel Radcliffe, of course, plays Harry Potter. When they were casting this role, they had 5,000 kids audition, or at least pictures of 5,000. We've talked about this before when there's that many. But Chris had seen Daniel in David Copperfield in 1999 and wanted him. They said they couldn't get him because his parents wanted him to focus on schoolwork and not acting, but eventually he swayed them. So I won't get into all the details. Other people that auditioned for the role were Jamie Campbell Bauer, Nicholas Holt, which is a name I recognized, William Moseley, and Jack Whitehall, which is another one I recognize.
Yeah, they spent months and months casting in general for all the roles, even the adults.
I'm sure.
They ended up going through two casting directors because Susan Figgis, who was originally the casting director, left. She quit because Columbus and Rawling and the studio and blah, 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 everybody had to agree, and they were not agreeing on a lot of people.
I would have quit, too.
And one of her things was she said...
Too many egos.
She said Daniel Radcliffe could not play this role because, A, he didn't look right for it, in her opinion, and his parents didn't want him to get all the publicity that obviously this role would take. And it took a private meeting with Columbus before the father decided to say, yeah, I'll let him audition.
Right. I had all that. I just didn't go into detail, but Chris eventually persuaded them to let him do it. I've got Rupert Grant plays Ron Weasley. I don't really have anything else on him except that he's still acting now. And we saw him in that Shyamalan movie with Bautista that was really good. I can't think of Knock at the Cabin. That was good. He's in that. Yeah. Emma Watson is Hermione Granger. She's probably my favorite character so far, even though I've only seen one movie. I like her.
Interesting. I've got a good segue for that.
Okay.
Stephen Clovis was approached by Columbus to write the screenplay. He said it was extremely hard because this book doesn't translate well to film. That was his quote about it. Plus, he had to be approved by J.K. Rowling, who did not... As a matter of fact, there was an interview where she said, I met him for the first time wanting to hate him because he was going to adapt her work and everything else. He won her over by saying, would you like to know who my favorite character is? And she said, who? And he said, Hermione. Which was also her favorite. So that's what helped convince her and... He's excellent. He's great. Until they got to Yates, he was the best. Yeah.
Yeah. These are in no specific order other than the kids starting. John Cleese plays the nearly headless Nick, the ghost of Gryffindor House.
Yep.
Speaking of Monty Python, that's a good one there.
Oh, yeah.
And ironically, as you and I both know, because of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, he was the Black Knight who had every part of his body cut off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in this one, he's nearly headless. And it's pretty gross when he pulls his head off.
It's just a flesh wound.
Yeah. Robbie Coltrane plays Rubeus Hagrid. He was the first person cast. Warwick Davis is Phileas Flitwick. Richard Griffiths is Vernon Dursley. Harry's Muggle uncle.
Yeah.
Then we got Richard Harris playing Albus Dumbledore. Now, we know from history that Richard only made it through two films, right? I think.
Correct.
Because he died, but he agreed to take it because of what you said. His 11-year-old granddaughter threatened him to speak to him again if he didn't take it.
Again, and a lot of us got involved in Harry Potter because our daughters or our children wanted us to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
And then my nephew's kids were young when they came out. Actually, they weren't even born when they came out, but they were born during them. So that he was reading them. Patrick McGowan was originally offered the role of Dumbledore, and he turned it down for health reasons, which is similar to Harris, because he had his own issues and died of lymphoma shortly after the release of the second film. Harris has often stated in interviews that he did not have much hope for doing this whole series, but he said he would keep doing it as long as he enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And obviously, that just didn't last long enough.
Yeah.
Other people considered, Alec Guinness was considered as well. However, he died before filming began. So that wasn't going to happen. Another one was Christopher Lee. He couldn't because of Lord of the Rings. He was already contracted to do the Jackson films. He was offered it again, though, after Richard Harris died, and he declined. So he could have jumped into it, but he decided not to. Ian Hart plays Quirinius Quirrell.
I know later on, he actually begged to be in it when they had reached movie 5 or 6 or whatever. I remember Christopher Lee, because I think he's now listed as one of the, 10 actors in all of England who have never done a Harry Potter film.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Okay. Megan Hart plays Quirinius Quirrell. John Hurt plays Mr. Ollivander. And then, of course, and I love John Hurt. I don't have to say anything about him. We know him from Alien. We know him from 1984. Alan Rickman plays Severus Snape.
Yes.
I can't say enough good things about Alan Rickman. He was handpicked by J.K. Rowling and received special instructions from her about the character.
Yes. She said, it's mythos for the Harry Potter world, but she said that when she was writing Snape, she could picture Alan Rickman in her head as she was writing the original novel. And she stayed in very close contact with him all the way through, because their Snape's character develops in a way that even the studio and the directors and the screenplay writers and everything else didn't know. But Alan Rickman did.
She gave him the backstory ahead of time. Yeah.
And there's another one without giving anything away. Oh, spoilers. But later on, because they do these in progression. So a book comes out and 2 years later, they've got the next movie ready to go thing. So they are, and then they're waiting for the next book sort of thing. But she did them fairly well spaced. And the same thing with the films. I think it was overall from first book publication to final movie release, like 13 years, I think, was the overall thing. So it was basically one-on-one kind of thing, or every 2 years kind of thing happening. Anyway, at one point, the screenplay writers do their own thing. They'll cut sections of the book. They'll maybe modify some dialogue. They'll change some stuff, blah, blah, blah.
Pacing.
They wanted to kill this character, this minor supporting little bitty character in the back, because they thought it would have huge emotional resonance. And she basically said, I don't want to tell you any details, but I wouldn't do that if I were you, or you will box yourself into a corner for later books and later novels, because she knew where the character was going three books later. Sort of thing. Yeah.
Tim Roth was the leading contender for this role. He was initially going to he was going to play Snape as well as General Thade in Tim Burton's adaptation of Planet of the Apes, alternately working on both movies. However, he later decided to pursue Planet of the Apes because he felt the constant flying back and forth would be too overwhelming. That was a bad choice.
Yeah. That one didn't work out to you.
Yeah, because that Planet of the Apes movie is kind of a stinker. Let's see, what else? Fiona Shaw is Petunia Dursley, Harry's Muggle aunt. Maggie Smith, of course, is Minerva McGonagall. And then Julie Walters is Molly Weasley, Ron's mother. I'm not going into a lot of detail about these, because some of them are new to this was their first film, essentially, the kids especially. But I do have some notes as far as the cast. Two celebrities were begging for roles. Do you know who they were?
No. Or I might know, but I don't have it in my notes.
Rosie O'Donnell and Robin Williams both wanted to be in this movie.
I do remember Robin Williams, because he even said he'd do it for free.
Yeah. And she wanted to play Molly Weasley, and he wanted to play Hagrid, respectively. Especially Williams, who actively campaigned for Hagrid and to whom he had done Mrs. Doubtfire with Chris Columbus. They were friends.
Yeah.
Actually, he had also done 9 months in Bicentennial Man, too. I've never seen those movies. But he had to explain. No, he had to disappoint them because they are both American and J.K. only wanted Brits to be cast.
Correct.
Which kind of confuses me a bit, because I don't know if you've ever heard Rosie do an Irish accent, but she's spot on when she does it. She lives in Ireland now, which is funny.
Yeah, it's fine. I totally support Rowling, because I think it does put it into a different feel to it. It gives us a different magical approach. Sort of thing. So I liked it. I liked the stipulation.
The troublemaking poltergeist Peeves was played by Rick Mayall. He does not appear in this movie because all of his scenes were deleted. And Mayall claimed that he didn't find out he was cut from the movie until he saw it.
Makes sense.
And he badmouths the film a bit. I don't have that in my notes, but I know I read it. However, what you were joking about as far as Brits not being cast in this movie, Sir Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen joked that they're the only two actors from Great Britain that were not in this film.
Yeah.
Or any of the Harry Potter films.
Any of the Harry Potter films.
Yeah. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. As far as awards, it was nominated for 3 Oscars, Art Direction, which went to Moulin Rouge, Costumes, which went to Moulin Rouge, and Music, which went to Lord of the Rings. Saturns nominated it for 9 awards, Best Fantasy Film, Supporting Actor for Coltrane, Supporting Actress for Maggie Smith, Young Actor for Radcliffe, Young Actor for Watson, Director, Makeup, Special Effects. But it only won for Costume because basically the rest of those went to Lord of the Rings. Yeah. It was a tough year if you were going against Lord of the Rings. There are scads more nominations and wins across the board. However, it is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list, and none of them are, which yeah. I find suspicious.
I find totally suspicious. I think yeah. I would probably go on to say, except for Star Trek, this is one of the greatest franchises ever. It beats out Planet of the Apes to me. It beats out Back to the Future, of course, the Mission Impossible films, the Star Wars franchise. So
maybe cinematically, but I can think of better television ones.
Yeah, there might be better television franchise.
I would say Walking Dead and Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah, but no, I don't think they'll have longevity. I don't think Walking Dead might, but I don't think...
The Interview with the Vampire has been around since 1976.
Yeah.
That's almost as long as Star Trek. That's just 10 years shy.
But Star Trek has had, I think, more cultural influence than Interview with the Vampire has.
So far.
In my opinion. And I think the Potter films will, just in the way they are produced and the way they continue to work and do.
Time will tell.
I don't see how in the world they cast certain people that they cast and the fact that they ended up looking, acting, and having the ability that they did in the last movie. It's amazing to me. One of those being Neville, one of my favorite moments in this is how Dumbledore gives the awards at the very end for the House Cup, which is an annual competition. And he has the whole great line about, it takes a lot of courage to stand up to your enemies. It takes even more courage to stand up to your friends. And he awards Neville a point. Neville's a little nebbish, the one that Hermione petrified. Neville grows up to be this huge hunk warrior fighter guy by the last movie. And you're going, oh my God, dude, how did you get so handsome and good and everything? Same thing with Molly Weasley, who is just this little bitty kid that you only see a couple of times in this, I think at the train station. And she grows up, spoilers, she grows up to be Harry's wife by the end of the series.
How so, dare you? I have not seen this.
Oh, I'm spoiling it for you. Oh, yeah. You need to get in there.
Yeah, you're not spoiling anything.
Trivia or production stuff, I've got a few that I'll try to trim down and be quiet
about. I've got one.
You've got one. Okay. The very first scene they filmed for this was the final scene in the movie, which was the goodbye scene at the train station. That was the first time that Daniel, Emma, and Rupert worked together on a scene with Hagrid, with Robbie Coltrane. It was the first time they got to know the process and what was going to be happening. And they're also surrounded by a working engine train and hundreds of extras.
People.
Yeah. So that was very interesting, and I'm sure very interesting for them to try to start with and shoot. They actually have footage and shot most of the first day with Daniel Radcliffe using green contact lenses because Harry in the books has green
eyes. Yeah, I saw that.
And he was so allergic, irritated by them that Chris Columbus ended up cutting them, and I have no problem with that. I don't think that's an issue at all. It also... No. Was the first and only time Hermione has fake teeth in the novel. Hermione has very bad buck tooth, ugly buck teeth in the novels. And because Emma had trouble with them, Chris cut them after this, and they shot on the second day without them. So that's the only time she had those in. What else? What do you have?
I have... Wait, I lost my notes.
Okay.
That the Hogwarts motto, Draco Dormiens Nuquam Titillandus, means never tickle a sleeping dragon.
Ooh, nice. Good.
I thought that was
foreshadowing too. Yeah.
And is that Latin? Or is that something she made up?
No, I'm pretty sure that's Latin.
Okay, because it sounds Latin.
Chris, I've said before that one of Chris's big stipulations. So we talked about Hagrid, or Robbie Coltrane was essentially the first actor hired for it. The very first person hired after Chris Columbus was Stuart Craig, the production designer, who literally spent months and months designing every single thing, from scrolls to wands to costumes to hallways, doors, everything. But he said in an interview, Chris was very adamant about locations too, going on location, having practical locations, having practical effects for the kids to respond to. Like when you see this, all of this food in the Great Hall, that literally is food in the Great Hall. Whether it's fake in places or not, he wanted it all there. Nothing green screen, ad later, any of that.
That's crazy.
He said, so like candles floating, the way they have candles floating in the Great Hall. Half of those are real, and then they supported it with green screen or with CGI. But the practicals are still there. Torches on the wall are practical torches, that sort of stuff. Stuart Craig said there are more locations in this movie than in the first three movies combined. So in two out of two and three, this one has more locations and more actual practical builds than the other two movies combined. What else? Stuart Craig was first person. The very first line uttered by Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter is his last line in the movie, which is, "I'm not going home, not really." Because Hogwarts has become his new home, sort of thing, which is great. Well, I think that's all the big ones I've got. I've got tons and tons, but that's all
okay.
We need to do to go forward. I just love the production design of this movie. I like Columbus's direction. Little looks and asides and how we throw suspicion at Snape because we suddenly have Harry look at him and then we cut to him and he looks down and looks at Harry. And then just these little cutaways that were very
well, there's also the whole MacGuffin of him supposedly cursing Harry when he's playing Quidditch and it ended up being Quirrell and he was actually doing a counterspell. That's kind of a... But and it's also stunt casting in a way because we always think of Alan Rickman as a villain because of Die Hard.
Right.
Too.
Right. And but Quidditch is another one where production design won. The original design and the way it's talked about in the book is it's a great big like Colosseum, like a stadium looks now. And Columbus and Craig kept saying, we can't get a lot of depth and unique stuff if that. So Craig was the one that came up with the idea of the columns. So it's surrounded by columns and everybody's in these grandstands at the top so that we could have people fly in and out of these columns and around them and everything else to add depth to it, which worked.
Yeah.
Which was really cool. I did have the pleasure of, since I own it in every version, I've got Blu-ray and DVD of this, but I watched the magical movie version, which has not only behind the scenes, it has golden snitches that fly through at times that you need to record and get points for, and trivia that comes up. So it's really cool.
Okay.
Okay. But I think that's all the trivia. Keys. Anything influence this movie, you think?
The books.
Yeah.
The books came first. That's quite obvious. And then if you want to go ahead of that, whatever it is you're talking about that's being done right now that came after the movies.
Yeah, they are actually doing a limited series based on the novels. Each season is going to be one of the books. They've totally recast all of the characters and there's no, I haven't seen any press that anybody related to the original franchise is going to be involved.
Are they having to work with her again, or has she been ousted?
As far as I know, she is still a part of it, but not with the same creative control she's had.
I wouldn't think so.
She had so much creative control of the movies. And then when Universal decided to turn it into a theme park, she had huge input on that as well. Even down to the butterbeer recipes, the Borgen bats, the French school that comes up in Goblet of Fire, their costuming and everything else, and who can be cast for that, all that. So, yeah, she's had huge influence on.
And who is doing this series?
Oh, that's a good question. I do not know. I'd have to look up and see who is doing the series. If it's not Netflix, I don't think. I
can Sounds look it up like real quick. Something Prime would do. But
maybe,
okay.
But I don't think it's Prime.
The biggest key that I could think of.
Developed by HBO.
That's HBO. Okay.
Yep.
The biggest key that I could think of while watching this is Willy Wonka. The whole thing reminds me of Willy Wonka.
Yep.
The beginning of it with him, the kid in Willy Wonka, Charlie, is not being tortured by his parents, but they're poor and they live in a house and they all sleep in the same bed kind of thing. And it's like Harry's being forced to sleep under the steps, but it just reminded me that he practically, and the letters are like the golden ticket. They just keep coming in abundance because his stepdad keeps trying to destroy them.
Yep. And J.K. Rowling has said that. She has said the two biggest influence, because, again, the story or the myth is that she's a single mom. She's homeless, essentially, and she is writing out this novel, her ideas on her legal pad sort of thing, while she was sitting in coffee shops and laundromats thing. And she has said that the two biggest influences on creating it were Oliver Twist, makes perfect sense, the orphan boy and everything else who gets pulled into this big, huge scheme story sort of thing, and Roald Dahl's Willy Wonka. So that makes sense that you picked up on that. So that's good. I've got the typical hero's journey. This totally is it. It hits all of the points all the way through. The mentor, having the big challenge and coming into your power, realizing it, that sort of thing. That's one of mine.
Hero's journey. I already mentioned The Damnation Game. And the reason I bring it up is because I haven't read that book in a long time and I don't remember it. But I remember our friend Wendell was working on some movie that he was really psyched about, that he was writing, that involved a chessboard with human people being the pieces. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, yeah, like in Damnation Game. And he got extremely furious and never talked about it again. Because I was like, that's been done. I didn't mean it that way, but it ended up hitting him that way, and he was like, he never talked about it again.
Hate not having an original idea.
Yeah, I think Clive Barker did that already. But it's done in this as well.
On one of the commentary tracks, Chris Columbus talks a lot, and he talks about his influences. Some of his were, he wanted the train to look like and feel like the train in A Hard Day's Night. He said that was his inspiration for the whole train sequence and the look of the train and everything else. Even having the little trolley in it and everything else, the candy trolley and all of that. He said that he was such a stickler for the power of practical sets and practical effects based on Beauty and the Beast by Cocteau. Because Cocteau had said somewhere in an interview that because they had these real huge castle sets and everything else, that the cast felt, he said it made the cast give a better performance. So that's one of the reasons why he wanted all these practical sets.
Interesting. So
definitely those are both influences.
I've got the theme parks. We mentioned them briefly.
Of course.
And I actually went to the new one recently.
Epic Adventures, the newest.
Epic Adventure, yeah. The set there, though, or land there, is the French land.
From Mythical Beast, yeah.
Oh, it is? I thought that you said the fourth book did that or something, but okay.
No, it's from her sequel series, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Okay, because the Ministry of Magic is there.
Now, Ministry of Magic is introduced in the fourth book, but okay. It in the Harry Potter world. But it's a different Ministry of Magic than is in the French world, which I thought was weird when they did that. So they've recreated the street of one franchise, which is in France, but the Ministry of Magic is all based on the ones from the Harry Potter novels. So it's very interesting that they threw those together. But we don't care. Yeah. It's the Wizarding World. It happens all the time. They're out there right now. Dementors and everything are out there. Oh, I have one you would like. At the very, in the climax, Harry finds out that Professor Quirrell is actually literally turban masking Lord Voldemort, who is possessing him and making him do these things. And Harry, burned because of his innocence and everything else, ends up burning Quirrell and forcing Voldemort to leave his body and everything else. But Quirrell does this whole turn to ash, fall toward the camera and burst into ashes on the ground kind of thing. Chris Columbus has said that is a total homage to Christopher Lee and the horror of Dracula and the way he dies, even with the hand out and everything. He said he wanted to replicate that as close as
possible. Isn't it his foot that gets what? The sun? The sun hits his foot and his foot like, or maybe
yeah,
I'm thinking
when
of a different movie.
Finally, at the very end, when it's torn down and he's he turns to ash and he reaches out and falls and...
Yeah, gotcha.
So I thought you would love that. Horror of Dracula.
Absolutely. It's a Hammer film.
Harry Potter.
It's British. Yeah.
It's British.
I mean, there was something else I was thinking about earlier that tied in that way as well, but I can't think of what it is now.
Okay.
But British lore.
I think you have to say Lord of the Rings, too. Not only the novels by Tolkien, but the movie franchise series by Jackson. They're very similar, in, like you said.
Well, Gandalf is, what's his name? Dumbledore.
Yeah. That sort of feel to it all the way through. And the fact that each of the movies, just like these, gets gradually darker and more oppressive and meaner and everything else, which is what happens in these. I've got one that's always hit me, which is the final scene. So we have the climax and Harry is there. And then Harry has a little small scene with Dumbledore. And then we have the house cup scene, the last banquet. And it always reminds me of the throne room scene in Star Wars. It has that same feel to me in the movie as that. The heroes are there. They each get their little rewards. Everybody cheers. It's all yay kind of thing. And you have somebody up there, either Princess Leia or Dumbledore, and they're actually looking off and Hagrid and Snape and everybody else. Like you see C-3PO and Chewbacca and all that. It's always reminding
you. You just gave me another one.
Yeah.
The scene where Dumbledore talks to Harry Potter in bed when he wakes up and all the presents are there and everything. Dumbledore explains everything like an Agatha Christie novel.
Yes.
It's like any questions you have right there are answered because he's in this happened and this is why this happened. And Agatha Christie's the only person I can think of. There may be a better example.
No, but that's great. This kind of, I guess what we would call post-exposition sort of thing, because that is in the book too. In that chapter in the book, Dumbledore basically says, for all you kids who weren't paying attention, this is what happened.
Right.
Sort of thing, yeah. So it's all out there.
Yeah. That's all I have.
I think you have to say the rest of this film series, not just the books, but the rest of the film series, of course, and the way they are preserved and done is pretty amazing. It really is. I think by the end of it, you'll have better appreciation and can get the taste of the author out of your mouth, so to speak.
No, that's not going to happen. We've danced around it, and she is batshit crazy, and she has been that way since 2018. It's been going on a long time because I've got a timeline up here on my screen right here showing what all she has said on Twitter since 2018, and it ain't good.
And I don't follow it that much, but I basically think that it's about trans, correct?
That's it her is. Big deal. She is. She says she's not transphobic, but she is transphobic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Her comments seem trans. The ones that I.
Oh, seen. She comes out in support of people that are transphobic. She comes mm-hmm. out. She's written books under a pseudonym that have transphobic characters in them. She's gone off the deep end about it. And it's a shame because to me, it puts a big black mark on anything she's ever done.
Yeah. And I remember, I think we should address it because obviously it is a key. It is an influence. Mm-hmm. I remember the first controversy was when she was writing. So the Potter novels had come out. I think we were just at Deathly Hallows for the film releases. And she was writing Fantastic Beasts, which is essentially a sequel. It's the American school of witchcraft, if you want to think of it in a different way.
And oh, it is? It's in America? I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. It's set in Chicago and in New York, and it is set in the past. So this is when Dumbledore was a teacher, was a young teacher. His first job was at a school in America. And so it's his story, his backstory and everything else. But she came out in all the press because somebody leaked it or somebody talked about it or whatever. But she came out saying that Dumbledore was gay.
Oh, no.
And she got all of this pushback from people saying, no, you can't have a gay mentor to my kid in his kid's book and all that kind of stuff. And she was going, yeah. Oh, yeah, Dumbledore's gay, has always been gay. I'm not suddenly writing him as gay. He always was.
No, and that was a big step forward for her. And I was very happy to hear it at the time. But the whole anti-trans thing is just...
And I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yep. I totally agree with you. And I think batshit crazy is true. I don't know why she has gone there. I know people are having... gender identity issues. I understand that. That's fine. And people can have an opinion, but an opinion that hurts another person, I think, is a bad opinion.
It is. And not to go off on the deep end, but as far as political things going on in America right now, they're using this as an argument like every other person in sports is a trans woman. And they're going to be stronger than a real woman. And she's very feminist. So I get where she's coming from. She's unapologetically a feminist and pro-gay. She's just anti-trans. And the thing is, the reality is that there may be one or two trans athletes in the Olympics. There may be one or two trans athletes in a state. There's not that many. There's more trans people than there are trans athletes. And a lot of that is what politics of it is using to wedge against the community, for lack of better words. I will say one thing that cracks me up. Stephen King has always been a big Rowling fan. They were buds on Twitter for the longest time, and then he just went radio silent when all this shit started happening. And the only thing I know that he has said is funny, and it is not a jab at her because she thought it was funny too. But she said something about something she had done, and she said, I don't give the square root of this many fucks what people think. And King wrote back, I think you mean fucks squared, because that's more.
Because that's more.
I thought that was a really funny way for Stephen King to come in and say something without taking sides or anything. But Stephen King's a big, huge liberal, too. He's not anti-trans at all. Not that I'm aware of. If he is, he's smart enough not to say it. And she is not.
Yeah. No. And it's sad. We've talked about it before. I think it was, who was it? Orson Scott Card, we've mentioned before.
Orson Scott Card's another one. Lovecraft is another one.
Lovecraft.
Orson Scott Card is anti-gay. Lovecraft was a racist.
Yeah. An adamant racist.
It's bad.
And again, my feeling has always been, I can love the art and hate the artist or dislike the artist or whatever. I can still watch a Kevin Spacey movie and really like Kevin Spacey as an actor, even though as a person, I may not respect or like him at all.
I can support the film franchises. I will not support her directly. I will never buy or read the books. I will watch these films as we cover them because I know a lot of other people were invested in this and just her. So I don't have a problem with that. But I'm not going to give Orson Scott Card money. I'm not going to give J.K. Rowling money. And I don't read Lovecraft much anymore, but that's mainly because he's not really that great of a writer. I mean, he had great ideas, but he's very cumbersome when it comes to text and narrative.
Oh, yeah. His prose is a little heavy.
Yeah.
I had to wade through it.
Yeah. But it's just like any corporation out there. If I know they're supporting something I don't believe in, I'm not going to give them any support at all.
Of course. That makes sense. And that's where we can, so to speak, cast our votes sort of thing in that way.
And like I said, that's why I was wondering if she has anything to do with the new series. Because Hollywood is notoriously liberal. So I would think after all this, they wouldn't want her to be a part of it.
Yeah, as far as I know, she is not involved in the television series.
Okay.
I think she was there for the initial development. But I don't see how she could, just in my opinion, just based on what I know of her and what they've already revealed casting-wise. Remember, that was her big thing on signing the contract, was she had this overarching view of the cast and who's in it and how they can be cast and everything else. And based on who they've already cast in it, I'm going, okay, and she doesn't have anything to do.
Well, see, the biggest move she made that I know of has nothing to do with the movies. The biggest move she made was when the books came out, she only sold the paperback rights. She published those ebooks herself and got all the money. And that's exactly how writing works these days. Most of the publishing houses are going away because people are publishing themselves. And she was doing it back then. She retained the rights to the ebooks. She wasn't publishing them herself, but she retained those and only gave Scholastic the paperbacks. So she made a lot more money.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, just glancing at just Wikipedia says about it, there are 11 writers on the series. Rowling offered positive feedback on the scripts for the first two episodes. So
feedback.
She has read them, but she is not involved in the writing. They already have 11 people fighting over the writing. As far as keys go, I do not hold much hope for the series.
Compared to these movies, which these movies are like The Wizard of Oz to people, I don't see why you would even want to try.
Well, not this close. I will admit, I said my icebreaker was Audible, and Audible has been touting this fully dramatized version of each of the books. And they're up to the third one, I think, now. But sound effects, multiple actors, the whole thing. And I tried to listen to Sorcerer's Stone. And
oh, yeah, you told me.
I can't. I just can't. He does not say. Now, Hagrid, the guy doing Hagrid and Hagrid's voice sounds like him, but Harry doesn't.
Yeah.
Uncle Vernon doesn't. Dumbledore doesn't. McGonagall doesn't. None of them sound, and I've spent 15 years hearing these people play these roles. That's the other thing, too. Other than death miscast, they keep this cast all the way through 10 years of movie making.
Yeah, and you get to grow with them, which is what I'm looking forward to more than anything, is to see them.
You'll love it.
Because I think Daniel Radcliffe's a great actor now. I really like him. And
this new show on Broadway looks amazing. It's a one-person show.
Yeah. And for you to, I think you said somebody was not happy saying that he didn't look like Harry Potter. And that picture behind me, he looks exactly like that kid on those books. I was like, damn, it's like really good casting.
Part of that is also wig, hairstyle, glasses, all that too.
Right.
Even when you look at early shots, because I think he had only done like a BC version of Oliver Twist. That's the only thing he had done on film prior to this.
No, it was Dickens, but it wasn't Oliver Twist. It was something.
Okay.
I've got it in my notes.
But when you look at images from that, you can see Harry. David Copperfield, that was it.
Yeah.
But you can see Harry totally. I'm going, why would you not? But Figgis, she didn't last long as the casting director because I think she did have, first of all, issues with too many cooks in the kitchen, like you said.
And it's too many egos. You've got a director, a studio, and J.K. Rowling. That's enough right there.
Yeah. But look what they did. It's look what they did. It's amazing. It's incredible. So that's what we think. I think it's incredible. Tim thinks it's a kid's book, but it's worth it. So what do you guys think? Let us know down below, not only what you thought of the film, but maybe the books, the franchise itself, anything else. We'd love to know. Let us know who you are. You can reach out to us anytime through email, too, if you want to. If you wouldn't mind popping onto Apple and giving us a review, we always love that, and that helps us reach other people. In addition to all of that, look down below at all those YouTubes and all of those. You're listening to us on the podcast, all those other episodes.
Those tubers
that you're doing.
Down below.
And maybe there's another film that you might want to look at and hear our opinion on it and key influences on it. And if you want to support us, like we always say, please go over to Patreon. And we have free content there, but we also have tiered content like everyone else does, including two additional podcasts and YouTubes that we do. One is The Dilithium Chamber, based on the original series of Star Trek, and then X-Files Declassified, which is X-Files, which is also getting a huge reboot television series coming up.
I'm curious about that.
By Mr. Coogler, so that'll be interesting. Yeah, and Tim, until next week, I guess next week we're going somewhere fun.
Before we are going back into Horrorland, and it is a redux. But before, I just would like to thank you again for doing the closing for me, because it was my turn again, and you just ran
Son
right
of a
through
whore.
It, steamrolled it.
You can interrupt me anytime. We are.
I know I can, but I don't like to. For those of you that don't know, when it's a science fiction or fantasy, I do the intro and the outro. When it's a horror or a suspense, David does the intro or outro. And this was sci-fi, and I was fully prepared to do the outro, and David did it for me again. It's like the second time in a row. So less for me to say.
Okay. So next week, you take it away from me, then, or what?
No.
Okay. All right, I will see you next week, and we'll continue.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Damn it, dude. You can say, hey, whoa, it's me. I don't care.